So, welcome. Thank you for coming. It's great to be back here. Feels like home after so many years living down here and practicing with Mitch and Gary and Jane and Wilbur and Carol and Joy and new people. I wanted to talk about the compassionate heart of the Buddha. One of my first teachers, actually my first teacher who I never really met, but just listened to talk, was Ram Dass. He was doing his tour of the universities back in 1969 or something. That's what turned me on to the spiritual path from the Eastern perspective. And I liked his definition of compassion. There's a lot of heart in it. You know, there's a lot of heart in Ram Dass's teaching. He said that compassion is knowing one's emotion, knowing another's emotion as one's own with the wisdom of oneness. So I like that because there's a lot of heart in that, but also there's an acknowledgement that there is an aspect of wisdom to compassion. Especially when we're talking about the compassionate heart of the Buddha, there's an aspect of wisdom that we need to realize, that we need to awaken to, or at least begin to awaken to. So over the years, what has really meant a lot to me and other teachers, I just called myself a teacher, but anyway, some of the great teachers have said that the heart of the Buddha's teaching is about the impermanence of phenomena and there being no separate self. Not that there's no self, but there's no separate self. And that all phenomena, all in throughout the realm of manifestation of the phenomenal world, have no own being. Nothing exists by itself. We're all interdependent. So how do we realize the truth of this, the depth of the truth of this teaching of no separation, no separate self? So over the years, that's evolved, I think, in Buddhism in America, and maybe the world too, that we realize what this no separation, this teaching of no separation is more deeply when we're willing to fully enter the experience of being human. As Jane said this morning, to be ourselves, to be willing to fully be ourselves, to enter fully the experience of being human in order to see what it really is. So what is it really? I still ask myself that question all the time. I still ask myself that question. When I was young, that question used to stay in the mind. It used to stay in the form of a conceptual question. Not so much anymore, but it still comes up in the form of a question. Thich Nhat Hanh, I studied with a group in Black Mountain, North Carolina. It's a Thich Nhat Hanh group. And one of my first teachers, Baker Roshi, from the San Francisco Zen Center, said, I think it was 30 years ago, he said, if there's a Buddha on the planet, there's a Buddha walking around on the planet, it's Thich Nhat Hanh. So in Thai's tradition, we don't really study a whole lot about other ancient teachers. It's pretty much what he teaches. And that seems to be enough. We call him Thay. Thay once said, he quoted the Buddha as saying, because there's suffering in your heart can enter my heart. So there's a clue there, there's a big clue there about what this experience of being a human being is and what the experience of being a Buddha is. Because there's suffering in our hearts can enter Buddha's heart. And because there's joy in our heart can enter Buddha's heart. And because there's love in our hearts can enter Buddha's heart. So if we really are willing, through deep inquiry into what is it, what are we? Through this deep inquiry, if we're really willing to enter our own experience of being human, Buddha will realize that Buddha enters our experience or was always there, right? So for me, that experience of Buddha's heart and my heart coming together, it's a very enlivening experience. But do I know what it is? I don't know what it is. You know? So often still when I get ready to sit down and give a talk, it's like, oh my God, I'm going to have to pretend I know something about this. I've learned to live it somewhat, much more fully than I could before, but I don't know what it is. But we know that it is. We know that we are. That's the only thing we can be sure of is we are. We're here right now. Suzuki Roshi said, the ultimate fact is that we're here right now. So I was talking with Mitch the other day, and we were talking about what's it all about, you know? What is it? What's the ultimate meaning of our existence? What are we here for? And it just came out, the present moment is it. This is it. And we hear that a lot. But what that means is that our inquiry, our questioning, doesn't go beyond this present moment. We can trick ourselves into thinking it does, but when it does, we're just, you know, we're getting lost in our thoughts. So Buddha wasn't interested in metaphysical theories about existence. He wanted to know, how do we exist right here, right now? You know, and what he discovered is there's this presence, this undescribable, vast presence that is lovingly and joyfully accepting all of the realm of manifestation, everything. So our human experience, we can sometimes say it's made up of our sensory experience. Well, there's our hearing, our seeing, our feeling, tasting, smelling, and I always add thinking. So there's six, right? That makes up our experience. And there's always a thought because what I just said was just a bunch of thoughts, right? Put into words. There's always, none of it exists without thought. So what is thought? Someone asked me this morning, someone who's new to the group said, well, what is thought? Thought is not what we think it is. So you can say, well, is it energy impulses? Just this, what is it really? What is the actual substance of a thought? What is the actual substance of the phenomenal world? Because without thought, there is no phenomenal world. No describable phenomenal world. So we don't know what it is. Dogen said, when you sit zazen, think non-thinking, or think about not thinking. When you realize you don't know what it is, that's non-thinking. So if we don't know what a thought is, we don't know what our sensory experience is. We don't know what hearing, feeling, tasting, smelling, or thinking is. So we don't know what this self is. It's just another thought, right? So we can learn to live through the practice of meditation. We can learn to relax our hold on things. We can kind of let go of the steering wheel for a while. Not be so self-conscious. Enter that realm of not knowing. There's a saying, you know, the famous Zen saying, not knowing is most intimate. And you know what that means? When we're able to be with our experience, without having to hold on to it, without having to push it away. When we're able to enter fully into the experience itself, we are more intimate with it. There's the ability to be more intimate with it. So, when we realize that everything is an expression of Buddha's compassionate heart, that's entering Buddha's compassionate heart. That's allowing Buddha's compassionate heart to enter. Kuang Roshi from California said, there's very few enlightened people because people haven't learned to receive. We haven't learned to receive the living spirit of Buddha's compassionate heart. So how do we do that? One thing he said, we should work, live, and love like the rain. The rain just falls. It doesn't ask, am I going to make a nice sound down there? Will the plants be grateful that I came? Will they be glad to see me? The rain just falls. Millions and billions of raindrops just falling. There's no self-consciousness in the rain. There's no self-consciousness in the wind. You know, so our life is millions and billions of these sense impressions. They're just falling. They're just dissolving. Right? I went to one of Thay's retreats, Thich Nhat Hanh's retreats, a couple years ago, and there's like 800 people there. And there's a little celebratory gesture they do. It's like everybody goes like this. And at first I'm like, are we Zen groupies here or what? You know? I don't want to be a Zen. But it's sort of like just the rain falling. It's like experience just resolving back to the source. I said to Mitch this morning that we're on the same wavelength. He gave a year ago he gave me this book, so if you've been around here, you've seen it, I'm sure. It's his friend Guy Leakley's translation of the Tao Te Ching. And it's interesting because we both, Mitch and I both, kind of got, in, I don't know if infatuated, but moved deeply.
Rained on
by this chapter 16 here. By releasing completely and cultivating stillness, we can see how all things take on forms that continuously dissolve and then emerge again. We can trace these forms in all their abundance as they appear and then resolve themselves back to their source. This resolving of forms back to their source deepens our stillness and reveals our boundless nature. There we finally release into illuminating consciousness. If veiled from this pure consciousness, our experience becomes delusion, and we suffer. Illuminating consciousness opens our hearts to compassion, and thus to the spiritual life of the sacred way. At one with the Tao, we can shine on forever in the eternal present moment. One part of that I wanted to talk a little bit about, where he says, this resolving of forms back to their source deepens our stillness. So in a way, you know, this resolving of forms back to their source is like these millions and billions of sense impressions that is our life. You know, falling, just dissolving, resolving back to their source. And it deepens our stillness. How does it deepen our stillness? Maybe it's like the rain nurturing the crops. When the compassionate heart has been absorbed, when we've been willing to absorb this alive, loving compassion that is our source. You know, it's very vast. It's boundless. And the more we can include, the more of the phenomenal world we can include in that spaciousness, the deeper the experience of that spaciousness is. So that's why it's not about being enlightened, it's about living an enlightened life. We deepen our absorption into the compassionate heart of the Buddha by fully entering our life. We don't necessarily always feel compassionate. I don't. We don't have to make ourselves compassionate. The practice itself takes care of that. You know, we don't. If we're receiving this heart, receive the heart, it does the work. We don't have to be compassionate. And there's a koan about this. It was in the book we were studying the other night, The Essential Dogen, on his chapter on compassion. There's a koan about Avalokiteshvara's thousand arms and eyes. And so probably most of you know that Avalokiteshvara was the bodhisattva of compassion, like sort of the divine feminine in the Buddhist pantheon, the hearer of the cries of the world. And she's depicted as having these thousand eyes and arms, you know, that she saves all sentient beings with. You know, 1,000 could mean 10 billion. I mean, it's limitless. It's boundless. The compassion of the Buddha's heart is boundless. It has no limitations. The capacity of the Bodhisattva to absorb all of our experience is boundless. So when we realize this, then there is no fear. Fear may arise, but there's a trust that it's just going to resolve back to its source. It's going to change. It's going to transform. So these two monks, the koan is about these two monks, and I have to apologize because I'm in a Zen community where we use koans, and usually, you know, you talk about the two masters and who they were, and I don't know who they were. I can get away with that at other places because they don't know anyway. But anyway, you know, they're senior monks, and one was, I think, the ones that appear in the koans are always become great masters at some point. At least that's as far as I know, anyway. But one's a little more senior than the other. And so the junior monk asks the senior monk, he says, "What does Avalokiteshvara do with all these hands and eyes?" And the senior monk says, "It's like reaching back for a pillow in the middle of the night." So it's like, you know, you're half awake, you're not really there, it's just spontaneous, loving behavior, just reaching back, just comes out. And the junior monk says, "Oh, I got it." And the senior monk says, "Okay, what did you get?" He says, "All over the body, our hands and eyes. So my whole being is my ground of compassion. My whole being is dedicated to saving all beings with my compassionate heart, with my hands and eyes and my compassionate heart." So these two monks have already realized that, you know, they've already realized that the Buddha's heart is their heart. And they're having a good time. They're kind of playing with it. You know, yeah, all over the body is the hands and eyes. My whole being is the embodiment of this compassionate heart. So the senior monk says, "That's very good. You got it. 80%. So then the junior monk says, "Well, that's my understanding. What's your understanding?" And the senior monk says, "Everywhere she reaches is hands and eyes." Everything is the hands and eyes of the Bodhisattva. So Thich Nhat Hanh has a saying that I maybe use a little too much, but it just moves me a lot. He says, "The world of suffering and discrimination is filled with the light of the rising sun. It's filled with the hands and eyes of the compassionate heart of the Buddha. It's saturated, completely saturated." It's like I was at the ocean the other day, and you pick up a handful of water, and the salt is all in. It completely saturates the water. So every experience reflects reality, reflects the true nature of reality, reflects the true nature of this heart, this compassionate heart. So we can say my whole being is, you know, dedicated. My whole being is my virtue. I'm going to live my life, give my life, surrender myself to this life of the Bodhisattva, dedicate myself to saving all sentient beings. But the senior monk took a little farther. It's like, yeah, but everywhere she reaches is already the hands and eyes. The saving of sentient beings is already happening. It's going on right now. For the junior monk, yeah, it's coming through. It's coming through. For the senior monk, it's no more coming through. It's what we are. We already are. And this is what we all really want. We can't know that in our mind, but that's what we want. We want that place where we are what we want, and we want what we are. So how do we express it? How do we express it? It's like reaching back for the pillow in the middle of the night. So being willing to enter the world of suffering and discrimination. It's a lot easier to do it when we realize that we are the light of the rising sun. If we are that compassionate heart. It's something we don't have to think about doing, we just do it. So when we enter this path, when we cultivate the willingness to enter this life, enter fully, the life of being a human being. What we get often is where we're caught, where we're stuck, where we resist. It's like the heart of the Buddha wants to live through us. It is living through us. He or she is living through us. But we suffer because we resist. We have ideas about what should be, shouldn't be. And so we want to bargain with it. Yeah, well, I'll let you in under certain conditions. You can come in and I'll let you in. Okay? I want people to like me. I want to have some money. I want to feel good. Sometimes it doesn't feel good. Letting go of this, of the confines of this small self, it doesn't always feel good. So deeply conditioned to live in this kind of container of self. We condition to think we're this little being and we're confined in this little kind of container that's our life. And so there's all this energy going into defending, expanding, prolonging, enhancing, making comfortable. There's all that energy going into making this little imaginary thing our container. And so we end up living our lives contained in this idea of who we are. It's not who we are. That container was never there. The container, all it is these imaginary self-conscious efforts to maintain itself. That's all it is. So in a way, I sometimes think that our consciousness as human beings has evolved to the point, you know, where we can kind of question our existence. We realize we're going to die. We realize things are impermanent. And we get a sense that there isn't anything really there that we can call ourselves. And so that's scary, you know? So we make up this, all this stuff to do to preserve this sense of who we are. We're afraid to let go. On a really deep level, we're afraid to let go. So Baker Osho, one of my first teachers, also had a saying. He said, real practice is like ham and eggs. You know, the chicken's involved, the pig's committed. You know, when you get to be as old as I am, you realize you're starting to grow a tail, you know, and your ears are you're starting to become the pig. You can avoid it for so long, but the commitment is coming. The full commitment is coming. Might as well be committed now, right? We've got the opportunity to deepen the practice by living this life, to deepen our connection to the Buddha's heart. You know, and the Buddha sees us slowly becoming ham, you know, slowly turning into dust. But it's a compassionate, loving witnessing and process. It's okay. It's okay to let go. It's going to happen anyway. It'll be done for us at some point. We might as well enjoy it. Why not? Things aren't going to turn out the way we want them to anyway, so why worry about it? So this resolving of forms back to their source, it deepens our commitment, deepens our grounding, deepens our stillness. And as when we share the Dharma, we're participating more fully in this resolving of everything, dissolving of everything, back to the source. I feel like I've talked enough. Can we have a discussion? Whatever comes up. Or I can talk more, but I'd rather let you talk a little bit.
You mentioned Ram Dass, and I remember seeing him in Hollywood.
Wait, say it again?
Yeah, Ram Dass.
Ram Dass, yeah.
In Hollywood, here.
He came?
In a high school. Mm-hmm. And talk about commitment. Mm-hmm. Somebody in the audience asked him a question, and he answered, and the guy didn't like the answer.
Yeah.
So he asked him again. And this other guy was there slapping city, just all over. A group like this, very mellow, you know, the crowd that used to follow him.
Yeah.
With the group from Miami, and Coconut Grove. Anyway, and the guy slaps him hard and pulls out a knife.
I mean, wow,
knife,
really?
Knife. So here's Ram Dass up there. And this guy's over here with the knife. And Ram Dass jumps up and says, wait, comes over, starts talking to him. Here's the guy, talks, totally. In front of this guy, to make a long story short, he brings him to the Thais and gives him a banana, which the guy proceeds to eat without peeling. He keeps talking to us. Ram Dass continues with his talk and with the guy
sitting right next to him. Yeah.
Next to him.
Wow.
And very soon, he just took the knife away and put it away and kept talking.
Yeah.
So,
you know, when practice goes really deep, the more you can include in that spaciousness, yeah, and that deepens. Think how that deepened the realization for the people at the talk. Wow, he's able to absorb this much. You know, the capacity of that compassionate heart to absorb anything.
Yeah. So open. Yeah. That's probably one here today.
Yeah. Yeah, Howard.
On Wednesday, I got an email, like every Wednesday, Heart Advice from Our Children. And this week it was called Removing the Armor.
Removing the Armor? Mm-hmm.
And she said that what taking refuge in the Buddha really means is taking refuge in the fact that the next time you escape, the one you habitual escapes, you can see where you're locked down.
You can see where
you're locked in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she used this great expression. You see how difficult it is because some things are sewn together, how to untie things sewn together with threads of steel.
Yeah.
And I've discovered that as much as I'm interested in all this for so many years, there's still something so intolerant when I disagree with how something's done or how someone talks. So what I find so helpful about a day like today is there's space inside to see that so much more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's moments where it's not that it let go, but it's less interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an interesting, I told this last week, so someone had heard it, but I practice it at Tibet. Four immeasurables.
Yeah.
They all mean to be happy and have the cause of happiness. Be free from suffering, the cause of suffering. And they never be disassociated from the supreme happiness, which is without suffering. And they remain boundless equanimity, free from both attachment to close ones and rejection of others.
Yeah.
You said it three times before sitting, which is a great way to begin sitting. Anyway, after I left there, I was in the great cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting in line.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, why not say these three things? So I just said these three things, just said them as they were. Suddenly it's like, wow, where did all these people come from?
Mm.
There was a sense of fellowship. There was a sense of feeling connected to them in a way I don't usually.
Mm-hmm.
So the rejection of others is a very passive rejection. I reject them by ignoring them.
Mm-hmm.
And by saying that somehow, they became as real as me.
Yeah.
There are other fellows there.
Yeah.
But it was really quite interesting. And I now think that I'm 95 all the time.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, Ty has a saying, we inter are. His organization, what do you call it? His Sangha is named the Order of Interbeing. And we all inter are with each other. So that's how we deepen our stillness by the and our interbeing is that process of everything resolving back to the source. And the source goes back out into everything. So, yeah. And also, what you said about the armor and the steel, I encourage people now to make use of whatever helps them. First, you have to become aware of the armor before you can let it go. And I remember in psychology class many years ago, we studied, we were studying about body armor, learning about body armor, and how we, past traumas that we have as kids or whatever, you freeze up, you tense up. And like with the amoeba, you see it's kind of it starts out as kind of a fluid, elastic organism, but if you poke it, traumatize it and poke it, it contracts into a ball. And then it kind of slowly opens up. And then you poke it again, and it contracts a little more slowly. And it's a little more slowly does it open up again. And you poke it again, and it's a little more slower. And then finally, you poke it, and it just stays like this. And so you get these bands of iron in your muscles, and you're just, defending them. You can see sometimes you see people, they're like this, Then when somebody like Reb Anderson came, his shoulders are almost down to his hips, He's so relaxed, so open. So whatever happened, I did some Reiki and body work when I was about in my early 30s. I moved to LA and I left the Zen Center and I was with this body therapist. He says, all your anger went into your zafu. You stuffed all your anger in your zafu and it was in my body, you know. So it was a long process of letting go, opening up.
It's interesting, the whole idea. I think for so many years I had such a misconception of what letting go is. It's much more embracing. Letting go of not embracing.
Receiving the Dharma, receiving the spirit. Let it embrace you, but when you let go of your defensiveness and your resistance, you're able to be embraced.
I heard this story recently. It was a teacher who was with a student who died of cancer and a lot of pain. And he kept telling her, let go, and she kept saying, I can't. And he said, then embrace it.
Yeah.
And she got that.
Yeah, letting go of your resistance to being embraced by embracing, being open. Yeah, so in that way, you know, and it's painful. So the willingness to hurt is the willingness to love and be loved. Yeah.
This is all very coincidental, but there are no coincidences, are there?
Only in the mind.
There's just the interconnectedness.
Yes.
So 3 weeks ago, my stepmom passed away. And we were very close, and I had been her primary caregiver for the past couple of years. And it was a very intense time with the ambulance and paramedics and hospital and funeral and Shiva, which in the Jewish tradition, after somebody passes away, the immediate family for a week afterwards doesn't go to work or anything. We stay together, usually in the house of the deceased, and mm-hmm. it's a period of allowing ourselves to grieve.
Yeah.
And the family and friends come and pay their respects. But anyway, on the way to the hospital, everything is, you know, crazy. Paramedics rushing around. And I decided at that point that whatever I was going to feel, I was going to allow myself to feel. And whatever I was going to experience, I was going to allow myself to experience. That I wasn't going to try to put on, like I usually do, the strong front. I'm not going to cry because I'm strong, you know, and I'm a Zen practitioner. Or I'm not going to, if somebody makes a joke, I shouldn't laugh because this is serious. But whatever I experience, I would allow myself to be that, to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was upset, I could cry. And if somebody said something funny, I could laugh. And what happened was, for that period of time, the next few days, and the next couple of weeks actually, it was as if I was living, it was kind of like a dream, but it was kind of very surreal also, more than real. And everybody I encountered, you know, there were like 30 relatives from out of town, all, you know, everybody's together in there, crying and laughing and carrying on. And everybody I encountered, there was no feeling of myself at all.
Wow. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, the Buddhist thing, no separation, no self, no separation between self and other. I thought that I would feel like no separation between self and other. It wasn't like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was no feeling of Carol, no feeling of self, but no feeling of the other either.
Yeah, because you don't need the, when you're really connected, you don't need the idea of separate self.
No idea there.
Yeah.
And I just, without having to think about anything, just allowing myself that openness, I knew what to do with everybody I encountered. And I didn't try. I didn't try to be compassionate or anything like that, but I just knew what was needed, whether it was a hug, whether it was a joke, whether it was holding hands and crying, whatever it was, it just happened. And the only thing I can say that I was aware of during that entire period of time was this feeling, the only feeling I could get beyond the grief was this huge feeling of love and compassion. It was like there was this big pink glow around everything. And it was just, it was so intense, the love and compassion. And this went on for like 2 weeks. Shiva was over, I was back home, I was trying to do work and stuff. And then the feeling started to fade. And I started to feel like my own little separate Carol again. And I didn't like that. I didn't want to leave that place. I wanted to stay there. I wanted to get it back. I wanted to hold on to it. But I knew that that doesn't work. You know, the more you try to grab it, the more it slips away.
Yeah.
And I was having a Skype on with my teacher, and I told him the story, and I told him about how I wanted to maintain that state of mind, that I didn't want to lose that state of mind. And he said, well, you know, the thing that created that state of mind was being open to whatever you experienced. And once you try to hold on to something, you're no longer open. Because you're not open to what you're going to experience. You want to change what you're experiencing. I wanted to change what I was experiencing to what I had experienced previously. So I was no longer open, and I couldn't experience whatever I was experiencing. So that is my practice, to be open.
And to go back to that
openness.
Where the idea of self and other just falls away.
And so, and I thought to myself during this period of time, I said, this must be what it's like to live in a state of grace, to live an enlightened life.
Yeah.
This is must be what it feels like. No self, no other, just this.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening?
One life.
And your talk was all about that. So
we're learning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. You mentioned other teachers.
I'm
sorry. Excuse me. I said, thank you, Roger. I said, you mentioned teachers, but which teacher, your Dharma heir in the White Plum lineage, which teacher was it? Mizumi? Well, I mean, which was your teacher that?
Oh, gave me the Dharma transmission?
No, I know he gave you Dharma transmission, but you mentioned teachers, Bhikkhu Roshi, Thich Nhat Hanh, and you kept going back to them. But you are a Dharma, you're in the White Plum lineage. Which teacher, which practice within your lineage? Is there one that still resonates with you the same way you go back to Bhikkhu Roshi and Thich Nhat Hanh?
Oh,
Mizumi or Peter Matheson or
probably Reb,
the man to the
Reb Anderson. He's the one he's inspired me the most within the Zen tradition. Because I got to know him, you know. I practiced with him when I was very young, but then when he came back for 3 years, you know, he gave I think it was 07, 08, and 09, he gave 4 or 5 day retreats here. So I got, and he stayed with me, so I got to reconnect with him. And I remember one of the years he was here, I was sitting where Carol was sitting, and he was sitting where Wilbur is, and he was talking about the depth of practice. I'm hearing, well, there's a level of practice where the whole incarnation, our whole life becomes an offering to the fire, you know, to the fire of the compassionate heart of the Buddha. Yeah. So, and when you become that, he said, and then he said something else. I don't remember what he said after that, but you know, he was saying, yeah, he knows what it was to live when you become that. It's living in like mine. And so I said, Roshi, when you become it, what is it? Because that's, I want to become it too, right? You know, like he has the authority to say it that way, you know? So I was telling Gary, when I give a talk, I'll say, I want to say it that way, but instead I'll be more authentic and say, I kind of would like to be able to say it that way, but I'm not going to be Reb, you know? I'm not ready to be Reb yet. But I said, okay, so Roshi, what is it? And he picked up his teacup, and offered it to him, and I drank his teacup, you know, drank out of his teacup. So that, it's like, you know, no self and other, just give it away.